I want you to be turning your Bibles with me to 1 Samuel chapter 25. 1 Samuel chapter 25. We give names to our children because they sound good or sometimes because they have good meanings. Maybe that we name our children after someone else in our family that means a lot to us. Or because they mean a lot to someone within our family that means a lot to us. And we give our children's names because we have to have something to call them by after all, don't we? But we don't give them names like Jezebel or Judas Iscariot or things along those lines because of the bad connotations that go with them. We give them names like Paul or Peter or Jacob or Joseph. Those names are associated with good things and good men of good repute found within the words of God. A person's name is very important, is it not? Your name in the community in which you live, that's an important thing. That's going to reflect upon you, and it's going to be part of your legacy, what your name means to people. And it can be good or it can be bad. Now, in 1 Samuel chapter 25, our text tells us the story of Nabal, a man whose name had a very unique meaning. Now, Nabal was a rich man. He had a lucrative business in sheep and sheep shearing. He was a rich man. He was of a good family. We see there that he was of the family of Caleb, verse 3. But it seems that the apple fell very far from the tree in this case. Let's read together verses 2 and 3 and let's look and see if you can determine what Nabal's name means without us actually giving it to you. Look at verses 2 and 3. And there was a man in Maon whose possessions were in Carmel. And the man was very great, and he had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats, and he was shearing his sheep in Carmel. Now the name of the man was Nabal. And the name of his wife, Abigail, and she was a woman of good understanding and of a beautiful countenance. But the man was churlish and evil in his doings, and he was of the house of Caleb. Now, King James Version there says churlish. All right. We might describe Nabal and the meaning of his name as fool or unthankful. One and the same. Notice the comparison between Abigail and her husband. Notice what it said of Abigail. She was a woman of good understanding and of a beautiful countenance. On the other hand, her husband was churlish and evil in his doings. Could the contrast be any larger? Could there be any wider gap between these two people? I've always wondered, how does a woman like Abigail end up with a man like Nabal? No idea, unless it might have been an arranged marriage. Okay? But here we have a very good woman married to a man that quite frankly is described in the Bible as a fool. He was of a good family. He had a great wife. He was very wealthy. He had much land. But that's not what the Bible emphasizes about this man. Everything, all that, we find there in verse 3. That's it. Everything else that you read in 1 Samuel chapter 25 about this man is about this man's legacy. And how he is remembered. And how you and I will remember him. If you've never heard of Nabal, you'll remember him for this. From this night forward, for how he treated those around him. He was a man that acted out of the meaning of his name. He was a fool. One could summarize his life and character by his very name. He was ungrateful. Number one, this evening, as we ask the question, what is the legacy of a fool? What was this man's legacy? What did he leave behind? Friend, as you read through 1 Samuel chapter 25, you see, number one, his ingratitude for his fellow man. Now, as you begin to read following verse 3, you get into verse 4 and following. David heard that Nabal was in the wilderness shearing his sheep. And so David sent some young men out from himself to go to Nabal. David had about 600 men, it seems. And they were hungry. They were thirsty. They were in a land that wasn't necessarily their own. They were running from Saul, after all. Saul seeking to kill David.
And so David sends some men out from him to go and talk to Nabal, and he tells Nabal exactly who he is. I am the son of Jesse. He gives him some identifiers as to who he is and what he's doing here and what he has already done for Nabal, whether Nabal knows it or not.
You see, David came across some of Nabal's shepherds in the field. And he didn't take anything from them. He didn't take their water, didn't take their food, didn't take any of their sheep, didn't take anything from them. Nothing was missing when they returned to the Nabal. And David tells him that. And so he asks, as we come, we'll be there in about a day. As we come, can you have something ready for us to eat? We protected your shepherds. As a matter of fact, your herds increased while we were there. They didn't suffer from any predation or anything. Nothing was missing. You prospered under our care, in other words. David is simply looking for someone to return the favor. Help us out. As we might term it today, I scratched your back, now please scratch mine. What David's attitude was in this, it was payday, so to speak, for Nabal, but he refused to help Nabal. And so when David's servants approached Nabal, he insulted them rather than thanking them. He excused himself by calling David a runaway. He says, look at verses 10 and 11. And Nabal answered David's servants and said, who is David? And who is the son of Jesse? There be many servants nowadays that break away every man from his master. Should I then take my bread and my water and my flesh that I have killed for my shearers and give it unto men whom I know not whence they be? There's something severely lacking in Nabal's attitude here, isn't it? As it was with Samson, as it was with David on later on in his life, as it was with Nebuchadnezzar as he looked out over Babylon, who did Nabal forget? God. How did Nabal gain the wealth that he had been given? I imagine God had something to do with that. And he forgot it. Look at all the pronouns emphasizing himself here. I and my, mine. It's all about me. That's what Nabal's attitude was.
Here was an ungrateful man. He didn't care what David had done for him and his shepherd.
He didn't care that David allowed his herds to increase. But friends, when you look at Nabal here, he thought every man lived to serve him. That seems to be his thinking here. Now I want you to think about this. In the human body, no organ exists just for itself. But rather it exists for the good of the whole body. In the same way, no human exists just for himself, but rather he is there for the good of all. Or should be. God didn't put us here to eat, drink, and be merry, but to make the world a better place. That's why he said what he said to Noah and his family when they got off the ark. To go forth and replenish the earth. That's why he said what he said to Adam and Eve. Go forth and replenish the earth. Occupy, populate the earth.
Is that not why, friends, as far as making the world better? Is that not why we're commanded to work? 2 Thessalonians 3 and verse 10, to provide for our families, but also to give to those in need, Ephesians 4 and verse 28. Someone says, in the attitude of Nabal, but you know what have they done for me? What have they done for me?
Now, it's the same question that Nabal asked, except he made up an excuse. He knew that David had done well for him already. They became your neighbor when they came in need. You look at the Good Samaritan in the parable that Jesus gives there. We label him the Good Samaritan. He was just a Samaritan that happened to be a good man. And he asked the lawyer at the end of that story, if you remember, who was the man's neighbor? Was it the priest that came and he saw him and he went by on the other side? Was it the Levite that saw him in the ditch and he came and looked on him? Yeah, he's hurt pretty bad, but I'm going to go on my own way.
Or was it the Samaritan whom the Jews wanted nothing to do with, and most of the Samaritans wanted nothing to do with the Jews, who picked him up and bandaged his wounds, you put him on his own beast, and he went his way, paid for his care, and if there was anything more when he came back, I'll pay for that as well. And of course, the lawyer couldn't even bring himself to say the Samaritan. What did he say? The one who took pity on him. Couldn't even say the name. Friends, all men are our neighbors. When someone has a need, we are to rise up and meet it to the best of our ability. When is the Christian responsible for someone other than himself? You know, that was a fatal flaw in Cain's logic, wasn't it? God comes to Cain and says, "Where's your brother Abel?" Cain's logic said, "Well, he knew where he was. He'd already killed him." But Cain's logic, his logical thinking was, Abel's his own man. He can take care of himself. Am I my brother's keeper?" was his answer. Of course, what's the answer to that question? In all sincerity, yes, we are our brother's keeper. Absolutely we are. We are to look after one another. We are to help one another. When is the Christian responsible? Whenever there is a need. 1 John 3 verse 17. When Jesus woke up, he would pray, perhaps eat breakfast, then he would go out and look for someone to help. You look at his earthly ministry, that seems to be exactly his pattern of operation. Get up before everybody else did, go and pray. Perhaps go sit down and eat a paltry breakfast or whatever they had on hand at the time. And then when he would go out during the 3.5 years of his earthly ministry, he was constantly looking for someone to help. Oftentimes it seems that we're on the defensive, if you will, so to speak, when it comes to our benevolence, aren't we? Rather than being proactive. Jesus was proactive in looking for folks to help. Jesus was going and seeking them out. Looking for folks to help out. They might have had the power in certain circumstances to do some things for themselves. But Jesus had the power to do anything, but he chose to help others. Here we have the God of heaven coming and being in the flesh, and he's washing men's feet. He chose to help. Friends, we ought to have the same type of attitude. We ought to have gratitude for our fellow man. We ought not look down on people in unfortunate circumstances, but help them. For this is our responsibility, James 2, 15 and 16. God expects us to imitate His goodness, knowing that vengeance is His. Friends, we ought to imitate Christ in all of our dealings. But as we look at the legacy of Nabal, we see a great amount of ingratitude for his fellow man. Let that not be said of us. But rather, let's appreciate one another. Number two, as we study Nabal, we see an ingratitude for his spouse. An ingratitude for his spouse. I can't speak for all the men in attendance here tonight, but I fully appreciate my wife, even more so now, even as you look down here and she's having to take care of a 5-month-old while I'm just up here speaking. She's told me 2 or 3 times since Jensen came along, she can't now not physically remember the last time she was able to sit and listen to a sermon all the way through. Or participate in worship fully. I appreciate my wife so much for that. Taking on that responsibility. And for all the other things that she does. But friends, when we look at Nabal and Abigail, whoever played matchmaker here, they clearly did not know what they were doing. When you have a man that is churlish and evil in all his doings, and you take a woman like Abigail that's described as being of good understanding, she had a good head on her shoulders, and not only that, but she was beautiful. And here she is married to Nabal. Now the only interaction is when she told him of David's mercy. Look at verse 37. Now when Nabal sent David's servants back, and basically told David, I'm not going to have anything to do with you. What do you think David was planning to do? Look what he told his servants to do. Put on your swords. I'm putting mine on, and we're going to go have a talk with Nabal. Except they're going to do a little bit more than talk. They were going to take what they needed from Nabal because Nabal refused to help. And you know David at this point. Nabal knew good and well who David was. There wasn't a man in Israel that didn't know who David was. But he was looking for any excuse he could to get out of helping out. And so Abigail goes and meets David. She entreats on her husband's behalf. And look at verse 37. But it came to pass in the morning when the wine was gone out of Nabal, and his wife told him these things, that his heart died within him and he became as a stone. This is the only interaction that we see between Nabal and his wife. And if you needed any further proof that Nabal lived solely for himself, there it is in verse 37. When Abigail told him of David's mercy, that David decided, because of her, I'm not going to come down and kill you, all his merriment was gone. She had robbed him of his joy. He didn't see the fact that she had saved his life, but she robbed him of his joy. And so he became a stone. If you can imagine, he's sitting there staring out in space and nothing can penetrate his thoughts at this time. He can't, the idea here, we can see him, this ingratitude for his spouse. There's nothing, he doesn't say a thing to Abigail. His heart died within him and he became a stone, implied by the fact that when Nabal died, nobody cared. Look at verse 39. Verse 38 first, and it came to pass about 10 days after the Lord smote Nabal that he died. Verse 39, and when David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, blessed be the Lord that hath pleaded the cause of my reproach from the hand of Nabal and hath kept his servant from evil, for the Lord hath returned the wickedness of Nabal upon his own head. And David sent, communed with Abigail to take her to him to wife. What attitude do you see from David here? David is relieved. David had every intention of going and taking Nabal's head. But upon Nabal's death, he blesses the Lord. He's relieved that he didn't end up doing that himself. Abigail flat out called the man worthless. Look at verse 25. Let not, my Lord, I pray thee, regard this man of Belial. Think about this. She refers to her own husband in a manner of speaking, as we use this name sometimes to refer to Satan. She calls her husband a son of Satan. Belial was actually an idol at this time, but the name became to be associated with demons. Now you look here, and she calls him this man of Belial, even Nabal, as his name is, so is he. He's a fool. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. But I thy handmaid, saw not the young men of my Lord whom thou didst send. She called him a worthless fool. Further, Abigail didn't waste any time in marrying David, did she? Look at verses 40 through 42. It seems she was relieved to be out of a loveless marriage, as it seemed to be anyway. But what happened here? And when the servants of David were come to Abigail to Carmel, they spake unto her, saying, David sent us unto thee to take thee to him to wife. And she arose and bowed herself on her face to the earth and said, behold, let thy handmaid be a servant to wash the feet of the servants of my Lord. And Abigail hasted. She didn't dawdle at all. She got her stuff together and she went. And Abigail hasted and arose and rode upon an ass with five damsels of hers that went after her. And she went after the messengers of David and became his wife. She didn't waste any time. You see relief when Nabal died. In life, Nabal had it all. He had money. He had power. He had a beautiful wife. But more importantly, he had a wise wife. Proverbs 18 and verse 22. We see that again there in 1 Samuel 25 and verse 3. She was a wise wife. He that finds a wife, Proverbs 18, finds a wife, a help suitable for him, one who will comfort him more than anything in this life,
one that will help him go to heaven, that man has found a great wife. But here, friends, a man that is ungrateful for a wife such as Abigail was, God says that man's a fool. He doesn't know what he has. Friends, man and woman alike need to be grateful to God for their mates. Men need to love their wives more than their own bodies. Her needs come before mine. And vice versa. You know, folks, often said, and I heard it, the own advice that folks gave Ashley and I advice before we got married. And I've heard it more times than I care to count. But there are so many people out there that told me and will tell others a marriage is 50-50. Friends, don't you believe that for a minute. A marriage needs to be 100-100. He 100% for her and her 100% for him. Because if it's not, things are going to get bad. Communication is not going to be where it needs to be. The love for one another is not going to be where it needs to be. Men must love their wives more than their own body, living together with them according to knowledge, 1 Peter 3 and verse 7, Ephesians 5 and verse 28. And women must honor and respect their husbands. And as Paul said, learn to love their husbands. Literally meaning be fond of their husbands. Ephesians 5:33, Titus 2 and verse 4. Are you appreciative of your spouse? Think hard about that. If not, why not? Well, he doesn't do much for me anymore. Doesn't take out the trash like he used to. Doesn't bring me a flower each week. Not romantic. I heard the story one time of a couple. A woman came in and was speaking to the preacher and said, I've got a divorce. I don't love him anymore. I can't stand to be in the same room with him. I can't live with this man anymore. I've got a divorce. And the preacher began to talk to her. And he said to her, well, I'll tell you what. He said, I'm going to give you a 30-day challenge. And at the end of the 30 days, if you decide that you still want a divorce, I'll help you in whatever way that I can. And so he challenged her every morning when she got up to fix him breakfast, fix him some coffee, give him a kiss on his way out the door. When he got home in the afternoon, be sure that she had supper on the table, had the newspaper ready for him to read. Just wait on him basically hand and foot for 30 days. She did that. At the end of the 30 days, the preacher called her and asked if she would come see him again. And they sat down and met once more. And he says, so when do you want to fill out the paperwork for your divorce? And she looked at him like he was crazy. Preacher, I don't want a divorce. I love my husband. I want to spend the rest of my life with my husband. So he said, what changed? So you know, it's the strangest thing. When I began to do what you said I should do, he began to do things for me. He began leaving me little notes on the bathroom mirror in the mornings. He would bring me home a flower or a box of chocolates from work. We've communicated better than we have in years. You see, friends, it's reciprocal. For 30 days, at that point, she was 100% for him. By the end of that 30 days, he was 100% for her. And they didn't want a divorce any longer. Now you have a spouse where they were ungrateful for one another. Now they're totally grateful for one another and they don't want to be apart. They want to be in the same room. They want to be under the same roof. They want to share those things together. And that's what Paul's talking about in Ephesians chapter 5.
as he's talking there and giving us that metaphor of the church. Should be like a marriage. Absolutely it should. We ought to be 100% for Christ, shouldn't we? As he was for us in giving his life on the cross. Don't be ungrateful for your husband or your wife. Be grateful for the spouse that you have. So we see ingratitude for his fellow man. We see ingratitude for his spouse. Number three, when we look at the life of Nabal and this legacy of the fool, we see ingratitude for his God. But friends, we can say with conviction that everything belongs to God. Look at Psalm 50, 10 through 12. Everything belongs to Him. That house in which you live, the money that you got in your wallet, the car that you drive, we are, as Christians, to use that in God's service. That doesn't belong to me. We are simply stewards of what He has blessed us with. Like I said, we can say that with all the conviction in our hearts. And so, friends, if you think your possessions are yours, you're sadly mistaken. That's what Nabal thought too, isn't it? We are merely stewards. We are keepers or custodians over God's property. Now, evidently, Nabal did not realize that. Notice his wording there in verse 11 again. This is mine. That is mine. This is mine. That is mine. This is mine. That is mine. I'm not giving any of it to David. He sounds a bit like the second Nabal of the Bible, Luke 12, 16 through 21. Both of these men kept their treasures on earth and they were bankrupt in heaven. The foolish farmer there, remember? He looked out and saw his great gain. I'll tear down these barns. I'll build greater barns. Then I'll just take it easy the rest of my life. How'd that work out? God called him a fool and told him that not his life would be required of him. But friends, sadly, there have been many Nabal. Romans 1, 21 through 22. We talked about that passage particularly this morning. But friends, being rich in God is the greatest investment of all. You think of Matthew chapter 6, the Sermon on the Mount, verses 19 through 21. Our earthly riches, thieves can break through and steal. Rust and the moth will come in and corrupt the things that we have. But if we place our deposits in heaven, when we place our trust in God, then we've got nothing to worry about. That's the best investment that we can make. Our trust should be in the God of heaven, not in the uncertainty of this world. God doesn't want or need our offerings, so to speak, but our gratitude, our thankfulness. After all, we're here because of Him. We have what we have because of Him. He wants us then to trust in Him, Psalm 50 and verse 15. Through this experience, David, unlike Nabal, he learned to trust in God as he expressed in Psalm 37, verse 25. Look at what David says there in that Psalm. Psalm 37 and verse 25. And it seems that he's talking about this particular experience. He says in verse 25, I have been young and now I'm old, yet have I not seen the righteous forsaken for his seed, nor his seed begging bread. You look at all the mishaps that David had, and God was there to take care of him as he's running there from Saul. David didn't go hungry. He was taken care of. David learned to trust in God. Nabal, on the other hand, he wasn't grateful for what he had. He didn't care about his fellow man, he didn't really care about his wife, and he certainly didn't care for God. Friends, that's the legacy of a fool. That's what we remember about Nabal. Now, let's put away our Bibles. Let's take out our psalm books. We're ready to sing the invitation song here in just a moment. Let me ask you this, friend. If today were your last day upon this earth, what would your legacy be? How would your children remember you? How would your wife or your husband remember you? What about your friends or the community at large? What would your legacy be? We clearly see how Abigail felt about her own husband. Would that be your legacy? Well, friend, would you rather be remembered as being grateful for the blessings of God? David gave Nabal's servants protection and peace. All he wanted from Nabal was food. Friends, think about this for a moment. God gave us Jesus. Jesus died upon the cross. He shed His blood for our protection from sin. And all He wants is our obedience. So friend, what will it be tonight? Seeing that Jesus has bled and died for the remission of your sins, will you shun that gift? As Nabal did David's? Or will you freely take it as it is freely given? Friend, if you're here this evening and you've never obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ, there's no better time than right now. All things are ready. Come to the feast. It's laid open before you. Jesus has died upon the cross. He shed His blood for you. All He asks in return is your obedience. My friend, would you obey the gospel tonight by being baptized, immersed in water for the forgiveness of your sins? Friend, are you here this afternoon having done so in the past, but for whatever reason, maybe you haven't been as grateful as you should have been for the blessings that God has given. And because of that, you turned your back on Him for a time. Come home. Be His again. Friend, if you have a need to obey the gospel, to repent of sin, friend, or if you just need the prayers of the church, please come while we stand and while we sing.